Introducing WonderSuite from Bluehost.com, the tool that makes WordPress wonderful for everyone. Website creation is hard, but now with Bluehost, you can answer a few simple questions about your business and goals, and the WonderSuite tools will automatically lay out your WordPress website or store in minutes. Seriously. From there, you can customize your design, pick your brand colors, and add blocks. No custom theme or coding required. You'll get content suggestions that you can keep or revise. And with Yoast SEO built in, we automatically help you get found in search engines. From step-by-step guidance to suggested plugins to an AI-powered help bot, our built-in tools make WordPress wonderful for everyone. Whether you're a beginner or a pro, you can join over 2 million Bluehost users. Go to bluehost.com/wondersuite. That's bluehost.com/wondersuite.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey everyone, Yas here, and I just wanted to say it's great to have you join me today because I'm sure we're going to have another fantastic episode. So whether you're here for the first time or if you're one of the repeat loyal listeners of the show, I truly appreciate you. But before we get to today's guest, I just have a small favor to ask, and that's if you could just take a brief moment to hit the subscribe button if you haven't already. Ensure that you share it with all your coaching friends, and don't forget to get in touch, guys. Let me know your thoughts on what you think of today's episode or any of the recent episodes you've listened to. You can do this on Twitter at The Coaches Net. Once again, that's at The Coaches Net. And please make sure you do, as I'd love to hear your thoughts, guys. Anyway, on to today's show. I hope you enjoy it. Have a great day, guys.
The Coaches Network.
Hey, guys. You're now listening to The Coaches Network podcast, a podcast aimed at anyone who's passionate about athlete, talent, and personal development. My name's Coach Yas, and I'm a UEFA A-licensed football coach developer, and content creator. I'll be sitting down with a range of guests to discuss their journeys, their life lessons, and how you can make an impact. Enjoy. Right, guys, welcome back to the Coaches Network. My name's Coach Yas, and I've got a very special guest with me today. My guest today is Shane Pill. Afternoon, evening, Shane. How are you?
Yeah, I'm well. It's probably late night rather than evening, yes.
Awesome. Shane, just before we get into the real thick of the conversation, maybe just give a brief insight around who you are and what you do.
Who am I? Well, I'm a son, a father, husband. I've been living in Adelaide for the last 27 years. I was in Perth for 9 years before that, and then in Adelaide for 21 years before that. So I moved to Perth, start my teaching career because there were lots of job opportunities over there. Moved back to Adelaide when we're starting a family. Former physical education teacher, science teacher for 18 years. I was on a principal pathway, wasn't enjoying being in an office all the time. Opportunity came up to try out teacher education, took 2 years leave without pay and tried that out. And I've been at Flinders University now for 17 years, teaching and researching in physical education and sport coaching.
How you started that off with very much who you are as a person and to other people as well, rather than, you know, your profession. But obviously in the back end of that, you talked there about, you know, having a career in physical education and becoming a researcher. So could you just give us a bit of insight around maybe what your if you like your niche areas for research are?
Yeah, when I came to the university, one of the professors was at a front office only a couple of weeks into my time at Flinders University, and he said, so you're the new phys editor, and what's your research area? And I thought, research area? I've just come from 18 years of teaching. I've done a master's in educational leadership. What's my research area? I'd never thought of it. And I'd been playing around with this idea of the game sense approach in my own coaching for a few years at that stage, and just came out and said, oh, pedagogy. He looked at me and he went, really? I said, yeah, I'm interested in how you teach things. So pedagogy, not biomechanics, not skill acquisition. I'll leave that to the scientists. So I'm a teacher. I'm interested in pedagogy, how people learn things. I thought it was really interesting that in a school of education, someone would be surprised that I was interested in pedagogy. So I started, my focus of my research was on a game-based approach broadly, but the game sense approach specifically, and how that could be used in both junior and adult sport. My research in recent years has evolved to look at how the game sense approach can be used in traditional games teaching and how it aligns with Indigenous pedagogies for teaching Indigenous activities, how it can be used for personal and social skill development as well as technical and technical development. And recently I've been doing a fair bit of work in the use of teaching approaches for mental health education in schools.
There's a lot in there. I want to take it right back to the start. And, you know, you talked there about research area, and obviously I asked you that question. From your experience and from your perspective, just how important is it, even if you're not an academic necessarily, to have a specialist area that you're actually you're focusing on as a coach? Does that conversation ever come up in some of the work that you do, and how important and prevalent that is maybe?
Actually, no, it's not come up in the coach development work that I do to have a specialist area, so much as it's important to be curious. We ask our players to continually develop and put their faith in us that through the interventions that we provide as coaches, our coaching programs, that the players will be better tomorrow than what they are today. And I think the coaches need to model that by attempting to be better tomorrow than what they are today. So they have to prioritise their own education in order to demonstrate that they're learners just as the players are learners. So it's more about how you go about developing yourself as a coach. And most of the coaches that I work with are game day coaches, and they're interested in how to improve the learning of their players, accelerate the learning of their players, have their players become more game sense, game intelligent, and how to maximise the capacities of the group of players that they've got with the limited time that they've got. So what's an efficient as well as effective way of packaging the program of learning over a pre-season, in-season time constraints that you have with the players?
I think it's brilliant that you mentioned that, because I think for me, even as in a coach developing myself, you know, one of the biggest things I always say to coaches is that exactly what you just said there, on it's not an environment where we're just developing players, but also it's an environment where the coaches need to be developing too. And if the players can understand that we're as much on that journey as they are, then I think that it can build a lot of it can lay the foundations of having some really, really open and honest conversations and relationships with your players. And I think it's such an important factor within that. And I want to come back to your research area. You talked about pedagogy being that, and obviously you mentioned the idea of a game sense approach. How did you fall into that initially? And would you mind maybe just giving some clarity for some of the listeners who are maybe not aware of what a game sense approach is, and how that then differs to some of the other approaches, which some would argue are quite aligned and similar to that, but obviously have the subtle differences as well, such as a games-based approach and teaching games for understanding, obviously where maybe some of this stuff originated from.
Yeah, fell into it is the right word. So yeah, it's quite a number of years ago now, but it was somewhere around 1994 that I was doing my level 2 coach accreditation in Australian football. And I was living in Western Australia, and Rick Charlesworth, one of the iconic Australian sports coaches, long-term hockey coach, very, very successful international coach, he had written a paper on designer games and his philosophy of packaging technical, tactical and fitness work, and explaining to coaches that if you get the game design right, You don't necessarily have to do separate fitness work, separate tactical work, and separate technical work. And your time is limited. And that coincided with doing the level two coaching course, also putting his ideas in front of us from a course that he had presented some work. So there was the article that was published in Sports Coach. There was a handout that we were provided of, you know, that Rick Charleswood had produced for a hockey coaching course. And I thought, well, this really gels with the way that I'm seeing that my head of department had been teaching phys ed. He'd been trained in the UK and he would start every lesson with a game. And while I wasn't necessarily thinking that he got his students further advanced in game development than what I did coming through a warm-up into closed to open practices and maybe finishing with a game at the end of the session, I thought that's the class that I would rather be in if I was taking part. So I started to move my planning and therefore practice closer to what my head of department was doing. I was having great conversations with him around why he was doing what he was doing. And then having gone to this level two coaching course and got some theory from Rick Charlesworth's work, it gave me an understanding of why I would be doing it the way Brian was doing it. And then not long after that, the Game Sense approach was released into Australian sport as a move towards a game-based approach. And that gelled with what Rick Charlesworth had been talking about and gave me another framing and another reason to continue down the path of being more game-based. And I only had one training session to prepare the team that I was coaching for the midweek games that they were playing, whether they were the All Catholic Colleges games or the state championships games, which was called the Quick Cup. And so I had to be very economical with my use of time. So I decided to focus on teaching them how I wanted them to play together, figuring that these are 17 and 18-year-olds who are playing club football. They know how to play football, but they don't have a system of working together. So, and I wanted to teach them a system and a game-based approach enabled me to do that, and had some success with the coaching that reinforced that there must be something behind this idea of doing a game-based approach. A few years later, transferred in my teaching to a disadvantaged school. So I've been at a very, a very aspirational, high-income community to a very low-income, English as a second language, lots of community problems school. And the phys ed teachers there said that, you know, kids weren't really gelling with their PE program. They needed to do something different. So we did an analysis, came up with a plan, and they saw that I was doing this, you know, game-based approach based on the ideas of Game Sense. And they said, well, we reckon we'll give that a go. And so we implemented the Game Sense approach, game categories across the curriculum. And we had a remarkable resurgence in interest in physical education. I think there were four kids doing year 12 PE when I started there in 1996. The year that I left, we had 22 students doing year 12 PE out of a cohort of around about 54 students. So we nearly had half, if not half, of the school population choosing to do PE from a base of four students only 6 years before. So the students were enjoying it. We're increasing the number of sports teams, getting some success with those sports teams as well. But most importantly, we're getting the kids wanting to turn up to training, to turn up to games. And we're getting that both in our phys ed classes with greater attendance and in our sport. So it was reinforcing of the adoption of that way of going about both my phys ed teaching and my sports coaching. So there was an intersection between, you know, sport teaching and physical education, and then being an educator when I went out to coach my sports teams and taking essentially the same pedagogical emphasis. Second part of your question was, how is a Game Sense approach different from teaching games for understanding, for example? The game categories, the core pedagogies of condition the game through modification of the rules so that you have a very clear focus on what you're trying to conceptually teach, tactically teach about the game is the same between the game sense approach and TGFU. Whereas TGFU has a very distinctive six-step cycle that you go through, the game sense approach is more non-linear. It's, you know, the original research report said the game is the substance of the practice session. Start with a game, focus on a game. Doesn't matter, as long as the game is the central element of what you're doing. So you don't have to start a practice session with a game, but you would be encouraged to. So there was nothing set in terms of a cycle of learning. There was no six steps to work through. It was decide on the game and then use it as a tool to teach. And that's different from, you know, TGFU, as I said, which has that very distinctive six-step cycle that you would work through.
And as you're speaking and everything you've just mentioned over the last few minutes, I've had a few different questions which I think might be quite relevant for this. And obviously, if I give a bit of context, so obviously, we've got me coming through my coach education pathway and my coaching education, and I've been doing, I probably started about 13 years ago, and what was back then considered to be the way of doing things was going from a process of technique, skill, game. That was considered, you know, the standard approach. Obviously that might have some benefits. And then what you're referring to is obviously utilizing more games, to obviously essentially utilizing games in a way that it engages the athlete or the players a little bit more. It might have to structure and potentially affect how you then deliver the practices or deliver the sessions. But I think the key word you used there was economically impactful. And I think for me, I look at it that way as well. I think you've got to be efficient with the time that you've got, especially working in an environment where it might not be I get access to these participants or these players three or four times a week. It might just be that once a week where you need to have an impact, and that impact could be as little as making sure they're coming back. Mm. So just talking to the approach itself a little bit there, as time went on, especially through my own education, we started to see more of a leaning towards these game-based approaches in different facets. And I think one of the ones that kind of really sticks out to me was the idea of a whole session, going from a game, breaking it down to maybe a technical aspect within the game, and then reverting back to the game to see whether there was any developments and what. But the initial game that you put on was almost used as an observational and assessment tool to identify where the support may be needed in this given moment. Now, interestingly enough, often now people use a lot of games and then they use this phrase of let the game be the teacher. I want to start there. What are your thoughts on that? Because for me, I think it's absolute nonsense, but it'll be interesting to get your views on it.
I think it's nonsense because you're there to coach. And in my 37 years, maths is not my strong point, of teaching and coaching. And my own personal experience is if you throw people into a game, they will play that with their existing toolkit. Even if the game is conditioned for particular behaviours, mostly the players will recall their known technical toolkit, their known solution patterns, and so it's retrieval practice. Now, that's really cool if the coaching intention is to consolidate what you already know, do, and understand. But if your coaching intention is to stretch them so that they are improving, it doesn't happen just because you're playing a game. Now, it might for some, but I don't think chance is good enough, particularly if you're getting paid as a coach. I don't think a coaching philosophy based on chance, that they might pick up something, is good enough. The other part of it is, you know, I hear Alan Launder, who many people might know from the Play Practice book that he wrote. Alan taught me at Teachers College. And one of the things Alan would emphasize is, yeah, they might play games and they will develop a movement solution. But the movement solution might be what he called a dead end technique. It will take you so far, but no further. And then to go further, the coach has to get you to unlearn what you learnt from playing the games in order to find the space to put in something new so you can actually be better. And, you know, we often see that in a sport like cricket, where players will get to a certain level because they've developed a technique, and then they're playing against better bowlers, for example, and the bowlers dismantle that technique and they have to go away and add something to their toolkit. And they're wondering, why did nobody coach me out of this technical error, this movement error, whatever it might have been? Now, even when we're at a skate park and we see people skating, that observational learning through mimicry is going, how did that person who is better than me do what they're doing? And they're having conversations with people, they're going to YouTube. So in essence, there's a coach. There's somebody who's better than them in the environment who is nudging and prompting them to move forward. Some sort, right? Yeah.
I think if it's a, you know, it's interesting you say that, because I'm now thinking about it. And I'll be honest, when I hear people say, let the game be the teacher, there's only two things that come to mind for me. This coach is a fraud. and that's going to be quite controversial. Or actually, maybe the coach doesn't have has a limited knowledge, limited reference of how to then support the participants in question at that point in time around what it is that. So they're hoping by osmosis that it's just going to happen, essentially.
Yeah.
But they'll never be able to then pinpoint, right, this is what the difference was. This is, and it's always going to be difficult to do that anyway, but it's never going to be a real, yeah. I don't think they're necessarily able to pinpoint, or at least point in the direction of where the development came from, if it did at all come at all.
I think that the last part is the assumption that development has come from playing the game simply by osmosis, which is a phrase I also use. But the evidence that that occurs is not there. And so there's no educational theory that would support doing it that way. And my bias is that I'm a teacher, so I go to educational theory to help me explain how people learn. And I know of no educational theory that would support just let them muck about for a while and they'll learn what you want them to learn, or they will identify what they need to learn. Some might. But again, that word might, I don't think is good enough if you're taking a paycheck as a coach.
100%. And I guess, you know, it kind of leads me into my next question of, if we look at that whole part, whole methodology, in my opinion, I think that to do that effectively and to be real impactful with it, that's a high level skill. It's a high level skill that I think gets taken for granted, in that actually what you have to be able to do is not only observe and identify where the support may be needed, but actually then have the actual support available, whether that be through tactical information, whether that be breaking down from an individual perspective rather than a collective, or whatever the you know, the observation has given you, and actually be able to do that, but without having it pre-planned. Whereas I find with a lot of people who go down the whole process, they've already decided what their part's going to look like. But hold on a second. But the whole point is to observe, respond, and assess. Again, if that makes sense. I don't know if that's the best way to describe it. But you know,
if you've got good data on your player and you've been doing, whether it be observational analysis or something more formal, you should be able to anticipate what the player's needs will be in that part practice. And essentially you've set up the first whole practice to confirm your assumptions about what players will need when you go into the breakdown task. I've nuanced it in the work that I call play with purpose, where, yep, start with a game for retrieval practice and to context your understanding of which players are at the standard that you thought they were, which players are ahead, and which players are not there yet. And then when you go into the practice, some players, because they're not there yet, will need a different practice task to the ones that are where you're expecting them to be, so you can nudge them forward. And the ones that are already past that, they will need something else in order to continue their learning. So you need a differentiated challenge point because you're going to have players at different learning needs. So after that first game, when you do your assessment and you do your inquiry piece with your players, the non-linear component of it is, do the whole group need to go to practice or only part of the group needs to go to practice? Do some players need to go back to that first game for further consolidation, or they need to move to the next step because they're ready to go to the next step? After the practice, does the practice prepare them to go to the next step, or is the practice needed to go back to the first game because they were breaking down in the first game? And this is where I think a game-based approach becomes non-linear pedagogy, and the craft of the coach comes in to know what their players need at a differentiated level, because you're going to have different challenge points.
Of course, and I think something that's really important, I think, about what you've just said there is, as much as you've identified this as the first hole, and these are the parts, or this is the part that we're going to move into, is actually then having clarity on what the next step actually would or could look like. Because I think that's where I find that with some coaches, maybe are so often coaching in the moment, they're not actually anticipating actually what happens if they do crack this. And then if we go back to, you know, your use of the word economical, it becomes uneconomical, because actually you end up spending like 40 minutes on something that actually they've done in 10. Have you anticipated that? But then again, it comes back to what you were also saying about understanding, you know, the information and the context we've got on our players, in that if I've planned a practice that they've worked out in 10 minutes that I anticipate maybe was going to take 30 to 40 minutes for them to do so, then maybe I haven't observed them well enough. Maybe I don't know them well enough. Maybe this session wasn't for them, but it was for me. And I guess, you know, my question to you now would be, is within that process, just how important is it? And I know this is slightly veering off in a different direction a little bit, but just how important is it that if you're not going to go with the games-based approach or use of games, how important is it that the game or the sessions, the practices are representative of the game?
There's a fair bit now, whether you're looking at it from an educational perspective or from a skill acquisition sports science perspective, that transfer occurs because the conditions replicate the performance that you're trying to do. So therefore, that notion of replication, that notion of representation, is central for transfer. I find some sports scientists take that to an extreme and go that unless it's in the game, it's not the game. If I'm passing the ball against the brick wall, I'm going to have variable speed, pacing, angles coming at me that I have to trap.
Yeah.
That happens in a game. So, yes, while it doesn't contain key perceptual information coupling, it still contains a technical solution that I'll need for the game, perhaps at a level of concentration that I need without the distractions in the environment. And if I was on the pitch receiving that from a player, I wouldn't be able to get, one, the volume of practice, and two, the consistency that I need. So I'm not one of these people that say there are no place for drills. I think the skill, the pedagogical skill of the coach is to know when a drill is the right pedagogy for the learning outcome that's anticipated for the player. So no pedagogy is wrong, only wrongly applied.
Right, and I fully get that, and I agree with the fact that that type of practice that you've just described is not that it's it can't be of value and it can't have an impact. But my thoughts on this are, essentially, if we've got an isolated practice looking at really breaking down the technical aspects in that way, if the players are not understanding, because the reality is we're never going to get full repetition. It's never going to happen. And if it does, it'll be so rare that you probably haven't even noticed what it's repeating, if that makes sense. And therefore, how important is the consistency piece, rather than understanding that actually these are the variables which are going to impact on my performance? And, you know, my view on it is, obviously, just from my experience, is that the reason why representative design is so important is because, by nature, as players, participants, we lean towards the game because we identify that as the end product and we identify that as the real thing. Whereas if the practices can be representative of that in the build up to that, and sometimes in place of that, that could suffice to give the players the engage, or get the engagement from the players, because it looks enough like the real thing. Yep. So there's an element of that experience. And unless you've got those, you know, those bits in there, then is the technique that we're then, and I think it comes back to your example about the cricket player, right? There's going to be a dead end technique that eventually they'll have to unlearn, because it's not in response to the real factors that they're going to be, or the real variables they're going to be interacting with, to an extent. Although one may argue, well, actually they need a base level technique here, but what's the base level technique in response to, if that makes sense?
Yeah, there are biomechanical markers of performance that are there that are in all sports. And when you lose, I think the trendy word is shape, and you can see that the performance decreases. Your consistency of coordination and control diminishes because those biomechanical markers are not there to provide the stability that's required for the coordination and control. And a very simple one, for example, is we look at head position of a cricketer when they make a stroke. And you can often see that a stroke is mistimed or the bat is misdirected because of the head position. Now you come back to then what gets the head into position, and you look down through the kinetic chain. So whether you start from the base and look at the footwork up, often that's what you'll come to in the end. Where were their feet? Where did that lead their head in relation to their bat? And I think it's the same with kicking a soccer ball. There was a Riley McGee, I think it was, kicked a scorpion goal in the A-League a couple of years back. And there was the group of people went, oh, look at that unique assembly in the moment, never been seen before, absolute amazing stuff. But then his coach is interviewed afterwards, because his coach is on the boundary going, oh. And everybody else is going bananas because he's done a scorpion kick in the box. And being interviewed after the game, his coach is going, oh, he's been practicing that at training for weeks. So this wasn't something that was unfamiliar to the player. And yes, he had never done that in that game, in that moment before. So from that point of view, it was unique. But was it unfamiliar to him? No. He'd been practicing doing a scorpion kick at the goals from various entries into the box for weeks. So from a cognitive perspective, that pattern, when that pattern occurred, that pattern was familiar to him and he had a solution. Because another player couldn't have done that because they didn't have that solution available to them. So we can, as coaches, constrain what our players can do by limiting the solutions that we allow in the environment, or we can open up the possibilities. So coaches are absolutely critical in terms of what is possible for the players to learn, what accelerates the players' learning, And conversely, what stops players from learning and stops players from developing completely?
I think it's really important what you said there, because it now makes me reflect on some of my own experiences. And one of the key things I always push for is that if you're not going to go, and not that you have to, but if you're not going to go for a practice which has representative elements of the game within its design, then I think as a bare minimum, as a coach, you need to be providing reference to the contextual factors which may exist and impact on within that environment, even if it is an unopposed practice, as an example. Really set the scene in the sense of, you know, it's not a case of, right, we're just going to pass the ball back and forth. Actually, Shane, I want you to receive this ball as if you've got a player on your right-hand shoulder, and have a think about how that might affect the way in which you receive this ball. Now, yeah. It's still not the real thing, but there's a representative element to it. And for me, I would go as far as saying that I think unopposed practice should be avoided, unless, of course, you're it's a one-to-one situation where, you know, there's only limited things that you can do in terms of that. But coming back to your use of the word economical, I think the most economical thing to do is, if you have players in the environment, use them. And all of that other stuff in terms of the unopposed stuff is not to say that it doesn't have its benefit, but my I guess the analogy that I always use is, right, this race is 100 meters. I can either be me running the race, or I can be Usain Bolt running the race. Now, if we want to get there and we want to be economical about it, and we want to hit as many kind of nails on the head on the way through, we're going to have to utilize the game, because that's what they're interacting with. And the reality is, you always get the argument, yeah, but there's not enough repetition. Yeah, but you're never going to get repetition anyway. So from that perspective, what would your advice be to coaches who are now still battling with this idea of, you know, we need to have technical practices, we need to have this, we need to drill in that technique. And, you know, if we play too much games, or if we do stuff that's much more game related in that game representative of the game, we don't get to work on that base level technique.
I think there is a need for a base level technique in order to be successful. It's a matter of, okay, so is every top class player, every elite player, the best technically? And my understanding from literature is probably not, but they're always the fastest decision maker.
Yeah.
They make decisions faster and more accurately. And their technical toolkit is good enough to be successful as a result of making those decisions faster and more accurately than the next level of player. And there's a lot of research, and yes, I know it's from recall, retrospective of what you did, but it tells us that during adolescence, the people that make the elite level played more games generally than the people that didn't make it to that level. So volume of gameplay, that representative learning environment, is important. Does it always have to be football? No, the research is telling us that it's immersion in the domain. So the domain is invasion games, basketball, lacrosse, hockey, soccer. They're, from a cognitive perspective, developing a similar brain because the principles of play, the pattern recognition, is similar. Now, they're not going to play soccer during adolescence, but we're not suggesting that the only thing they need to do is play soccer in order to become an elite soccer player. In fact, there's a push towards, you know, make sure that they are a multi-sport athlete for as long as possible. But my understanding of the science would see the multi-sport athlete in the domain, and the domain is invasion games.
I think it's really important that you've mentioned that, because I think the principles of play are so key here. And I think for me, you hear so many stories around players who have gone on to become professionals that actually have come from maybe multiple backgrounds, and then eventually gone to down the idea of specialising. But I think it's really interesting how you put it as in the domain of invasion games, and the specificity of it being invasion games, because obviously there is some cross, you know, there's some transferable principles that work across all these sports. But I guess are you suggesting then as a coach that without having a strong underpinning and understanding of the principles of play, that you probably can't be as effective as, well, there's a limit to your effectiveness in that respect?
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
There's a limit to your effectiveness in being able to put into place representative practice designs if you don't understand the principles of play. The principles of play will lead to the tactics. And when I talk about tactics, I'm referring to the solutions that the player will put in place at the moment and the strategies, how you're going to help your team get a sense of synergy because they understand what their teammates will do in particular. So they can read the context because they have an anticipation of what their teammates should be doing in that context. So yes, if you don't have a good understanding of the principles of play, then it would be difficult to be a game-based coach. Now, that's, I don't think that's anything new. If you go to the work of Alan Wade from the late 1960s, Eric Worthington, who also came out of Loughborough from the early 1970s, they were emphasising principles of play to develop a tactical framework that through a common language that all the players would understand, but the tactical framework that they laid out for football equally applies to basketball and water polo and lacrosse and hockey because they're invasion games. So there's nothing new in this perspective that to be a game-based approach and put representative task design to your players, you need to understand the principles of play of the game.
Yeah, and I fully agree with you because I guess where I'm leading this to is now, if without a foot, because my fundamental belief is that if you don't have the understanding of the principles of play, then you're not fully aware of the environmental and contextual factors which could then impact on performance technically. And I wanted to kind of maybe rephrase something I mentioned earlier on there being a base level technique. I think more specifically, in my opinion, what there is not necessarily a base level technique, but there's some universal factors which can be agreed upon that these are directly impacting on technique. Not that it has to be done in a particular way, but these are the areas that we need to consider, if that makes sense. So, potentially, if using your cricket example, the position of the head or the biomechanical factors that are directly having an effect on the outcome of the technical aspects. And I think another thing that you mentioned obviously as well is that the best athletes in this respect are the ones who make the best decisions. In the game sense approach, and even in just the delivery of games and using games as a tool for learning, would you suggest that there's less room for a more command style direct kind of approach to coaching and it's more geared and more supported and maybe aligned to using maybe a more open communication in terms of guided discovery, maybe a Q&A approach? Would you say, is there any kind of direct correlation to one or the other?
It's a great question, and I used to think that there was more correlation to guided discovery in a game-based approach. It was my colleague, Brendan Soucy, who got me questioning that. Mostly the questions that I hear coaches ask their players are not nudging their players towards greater levels of performance. They're questions that are asking the players to recall their understanding of the cognitive framing the coaches have provided them at the start of training through the principle of play leading to a tactical perspective, leading to the strategy the team's going to play with. So it's after that cueing, that cognitive framing that's been provided by the coach, the questioning becomes really, how well do you understand? How well are you recalling what we've just done? So it's a form of elaboration. The most game-based approach, most examples that I see coaches using a game-based approach are practice-style pedagogy, using Mostyn's phrase. Because the players are practicing what they've been told to do. Even from an ecological perspective, there are illustrations of a constraints-led approach and nuances of that, which actually set out, these are the rules, this is what you have to do, and this is the outcome. So the players are cognitively cued before they play the game. So they're not discovering anything. Unless you actually put the players out there and go, here's what you have to do, score a goal. Now, go and play.
Well, I think it's really interesting you said it, because I often, for me, is if I just give you the task and let you crack on, that's exploration, right? All I've done is giving you direction I want you to go in. How you get there is up to you. And I think this is one of the things I think, I often have debates with coaches about, is that why is the process important to you? If they've achieved the outcome that you've set, why is the process important?
It's not necessarily exploration. If they can solve the problem that you've given them with their existing technical and tactical understanding,
sure.
It's recall.
Of course. So then in response to that, then my question to you would be, what are the typical questions or the typical dialogue that you see and you would describe as an example of them cueing and being very, essentially what you're suggesting is that it can be quite leading rather than open. Is that fair?
Yeah.
What would be the example of questions?
And
what would you recommend that coaches maybe drift towards to become more explorative?
That depends on whether the practice is designed to be explorative. Most coaches have a system that they want their players to play to. If they're really good at their craft, they will think about the tools that they have in front of them, the players, the athletic profile of those players, where they are in their game development, and they will develop a style of play based on the players that they've got and in terms of where their players can get to as well. So you've got to match your players to the system. If your players don't match the system, you've got to get different players who can play the system that you want. So it's not exploration. It's not, okay, here's an outcome. What do you know about this? Okay, these are all the things that you know about this. You can't use them anymore. Find something new. That's exploration. But so when we look at the task instructions, if the task instructions are, tell me everything you know about this problem in the game or this objective in the game, right?
Yeah.
That's everything that you currently know. So if we see that in the game, that's not exploration, that's retrieval practice. So if we list all of those things and go, right, you can't use any of them in the game, you have to find another way. Now we're into exploration.
Yeah, no, I'm smiling because it just reminds me of a direct example I've got in my head of when I've actually been working with players, and I literally say to them, right, here's your task. Go ahead, work it out. Give me a solution for it. They've given me the solution. I said, all right, brilliant. Now we're going to do it again, but you can't use that same solution.
Yep.
And then it's just, we keep going. We keep exhausting them around all the possibilities that they can potentially come up with and come up with as many solutions as possible. And then I go down the line of, okay, fine. Based on all the solutions that you've tried, which ones did you feel most comfortable with? Which ones do you feel the most effective? And do they align? Like, did you find that with some, as an example, let's just take a Cruyff turn as an example. Or did you find that when you did your Cruyff turn with your right foot, as opposed to when you did it with your left foot, it had an impact on it? This is the exploration, because I'm now getting to unpack and understand and learn about the context of which they've applied it. Because actually, was it that the right footed Cruyff turn was more impactful, more effective, more comfortable? Or was it the fact that when you did the right footed one, the defender was on the wrong side of you? Therefore, the perception is it was more comfortable and more impactful, but actually it's because of where the defender was rather than the actual use of your left, your right foot, as an example. And I mean, would you agree and suggest that that's going down the explorative route? Or
I would say it is, yeah, absolutely, because you're exhausting their understanding and you're taking them to find a unique solution. That's exploration, and they'll be able to either understand or do something that they couldn't do before.
Sure. So then I guess the thing that comes to mind now then is, I believe now then, based on what you've explained to me, that is that there's a danger that a lot of coaches, and certainly with my observations, a lot of coaches are suggesting some of the work that they're doing is very much player-centered, or rather, it's player-led, but it's in some ways still coach-centered. Or, I think I got that the right way around.
I would argue that it's still player-centered, because you're asking them to do the thinking by the questions you're asking, but you're not taking them to a place of discovery unless you've got their complete thinking visible to you. And then you're saying, now that we've got your complete thinking visible, you can't do any of that stuff.
But is that where we have to maybe distinguish and get clarity on the difference between player-centered and player-led? In that it could be player-led, but focused around where the coach maybe wants to take it, if that makes sense. Then it's player-led, but coach-centered, or maybe, I don't know.
Yeah, that's where Mostyn's spectrum of coaching styles that we published last year is really useful, because there is that nuance between being player-centered and player-led, where the player is actually asking the questions and the coach is becoming a resource to help ask it, as distinct from the coach asking the questions.
Because, you know, I think it's a great point, because obviously in many cases, I think it can be misunderstood and misunderstood that actually the players are not at the center of it if the coach is leading it. But actually, they're two separate things, aren't they? And I think this is, for me, where, again, you go full circle and go back to the idea of let the game be the teacher. Oh, yeah, we're making it player-centered. And actually, is it really player-centered?
Yeah, I think in the literature, the distinction between coach-centered and player-centered comes down to the nature of the dialogue. So the coach that is always directive, command style, is coach-centered. The coach that deliberately matches the pedagogy to the learner need to get the outcome of improving the player, that's player-centered, because you're diagnosing the need of that player and intentionally using a pedagogy the player needs to get the performance improvement. If that happens to be command, because you're at the stage where you need to engage your prefrontal cortex and give concentration to it, it's not going to be myelinated to the extent that the neural pathways are really efficient, and so you can bypass prefrontal cortex and, you know, be automatic. So you need the players to concentrate on it. Then you may be more commanding, but commanding, it doesn't necessarily mean that you're telling. It can also be the way that you're asking a question. Yeah. You are just commanding a behavior by the use of the question as well.
Right, of course. And just to build on that then, you know, something that kind of jumps at me in my head is that, how important is it then that the players are fully aware of the process that is being carried out, if that makes sense? Is there anything that suggests that their awareness of the process can have a direct influence on how effective or impactful that can be? I don't know if the question makes sense to you, though.
It does. It comes down to your theoretical perspective. If you If you are comfortable in educational psychology, which tends to come from a cognitive perspective, then you would say it's critical that the players know why they're doing what they're doing and what the success criteria is. Otherwise, the players have no self-determination that they are being successful and they've got it. They've got to wait for the coach to say, you're successful and you've got it. So having success criteria, knowing what the outcome is that's expected, the goal, is essential in what we call explicit teaching, so that the player can have the capacity to be self-directed and self-aware of the learning that is occurring.
And then just to build on that then, you know, you talked about explicit teaching implicitly, then how important is it that they're able to actually articulate and demonstrate their understanding and their perception of it? Or is that not as important as just having the awareness of it? That makes sense.
Oh, you have to be able to do it. So there's a level of cognition where I can tell you what's happening in the game, but I'm not able to do it yet.
Sure.
Yeah, so I can't play football, but I can tell you how to play football. So someone who is skillful knows what to do, has the toolkit to be able to do it in the context of the game.
Yeah. And I mean, the reason why I asked the question is because you get this age old thing of people saying, oh, it's just instinct. But is it then for me? I don't believe it is. I believe there's clearly some awareness taking place, whether it's conscious or subconscious. There's a reading of the of perception. You know, there's things that you're identifying, like you said earlier about, you know, in some ways it might be distorted based on recall, but actually certain things have happened in that environment, in that moment where you've interacted with this variable, that variable, this information has come across to you, whether you realize it or not. That's then formulated the decision that you've actually ended up making. At least that's how I see it anyway. So I guess, is there a level at which they actually should have an understanding what those variables are and that it doesn't lean on the idea of instinct, if that makes sense?
Yeah, it's a great one. So instinct and intuition, is that based on your awareness, which is based on your understanding? From my reading of some of the neuroscience, yes, it's like creativity. Creativity is actually built on your knowledge of the area that you're working in.
Of course.
So creativity is not some magical thing that just happens. It's actually built on your knowledge, awareness, your understanding of the situation and capacity to take that and apply it to new and novel solutions. And that's where the creativity piece would come in, the application to the new, the novel, the unique situation.
Yeah, because
so again, we can't be instinctive on things that we have no knowledge of.
Yes. Yes. Because I essentially what you're saying, and this is, you know, this is the way I view, you know, creativity in that respect as well, is that, yes, it's creative in the sense that I've come up with different solutions to different, you know, different processes, if you like. But actually, those processes are based on the framework of what I believe can exist, and what's human, you know, what's physically possible, and that's not something that can be made up. That's a perception. If I, you know, if I look at it from this side of the equation, I say, well, actually, from where I'm standing, it doesn't look like 4 feet; it looks like six. Now I'm looking at it as actually I can do six feet or 6 meters worth of movement there. Yep. Whereas if I'm looking at it from that perspective, I've only got access to the four, then I'm only going to react to the four and be limited by that. So I guess, so coming back to my previous question, when suggesting that obviously a games-based approach may align itself to a particular type of coaching style, what are some questions which you think are really effective and positive for coaches to lean on in delivering that games-based approach and really extracting and becoming more economical with the use of that?
I think it's very contextual, and it depends on the age, experience, the direction you want to take them in. In my Play with Purpose work, I've got a framework so coaches can think about the questions that are intentional going in. So everything's aligned. The questions support the learning. They're not ad hoc in the moment questions. If they're ad hoc in the moment questions, you're not intentionally aligning from pre-impact planning to impact delivery to post-impact reflection. So The questions need to be as intentionally designed as the activities that you're getting people to do. So within that, though, we can always think that the questions will always be about time, space, force, flow or momentum of the game, and the consistency of coordination and control of our body.
So just to build on that then, is there any guidance around when these approaches should start to be introduced? So, I mean, I'm of the mind that you can start with these games-based approaches from as young as four or at entry level. But I often get the refute of, well, they've got no technique. Well, my experience tells me if I throw them into a game, they're going to work it out. yes, there's going to be some support from me in terms of some of the considerations and the variables that I wanted to really take on board and identify and become comfortable and familiar with. But ultimately, if I put a ball on the pitch and there's 2v2 and they're 4 years old, guess what they're going to do? They're going to run after the ball. They're going to try and move the ball from A to B to wherever they feel is appropriate. And they're going to try and end up scoring. Now, over time, through the interaction that I have with them, they will identify for themselves what processes have been effective for them. Because it's not let the game be the teacher. I'm here to facilitate and support the learning element and bring their attention to some of the things that may not have considered at this point yet, that are essentially having a direct impact on them, whether they realize it or not, i.e. that same movement pattern, that same movement solution that they're currently utilizing isn't going to work against Shane in the same way it's going to work against John. But it's my job to now help them determine and understand the reasons as to why that is the case. Yep. And if I can help them do that and get them to become attuned to those factors, then yes, you can start the game from as young as 3, 4, or at entry level, or whatever age or stage they're at. What are your thoughts on that? And what would your guidance be to coaches who may be still resistant and leaning on the idea, well, they need to have some basic level technique or whatever that ends up looking like in theory, but they need to have something before they can go into that.
Yeah, I agree with you. You can start a game from entry level, but also what a young person will consider a game, someone with more experience will consider a drill, because the challenge point determines the level of motivation. So, for example, I put a target between you and I and go, first one to hit the target scores a goal.
Yeah.
And I'm 4 years of age and I'm still learning to coordinate and control my body, and get my foot in the right position to hit the ball with the right force to project the ball. That's a game.
Yes.
Now, if I do that with a 24-year-old playing Premier League, that ain't a game. That's a drill.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. So then I guess it kind of leads me onto something else that I've been playing around with in my head over the last few weeks and months in particular around is really just the most important thing to, you know, get everyone in a state of flow.
Oh, gee, that's taken us in a different direction. I've got a PhD student who's actually looking at the moment in table tennis. Yeah, do elite athletes always operate in flow, or do they operate at peak? And there's some contention around when it's peak and when it's flow, because athletes tell us there are times when they have to pay more conscious attention to what's going on, and there are times when things just seem to happen.
Yeah.
So the question that I don't have the answer to, because I haven't read an answer in the literature at the moment, is when is it peak and when is it flow, and do athletes have to be in the flow for optimal performance, or is it enough to be at peak?
Surely it's subjective though, right?
Yep.
It's my perception of whether I'm in flow or peak. And
no, there are what am I going to call them? There are markers,
yeah,
of being in flow. And if those markers are absent, you're not in flow. The characteristics. So if you hit, yeah, these characteristics, you're going to be in flow. If a couple of those characteristics are not there, the question becomes, we haven't hit all the characteristics. So were you in flow? Do you have to have all the characteristics, or are there central characteristics and others? And I think from my understanding of the work with my PhD at the Stu at the moment, that's one of the questions that's being asked.
Right. And but then is it possible that those characteristics are perceived differently? And therefore, it could be flow, but not peak, and vice versa.
It could be. If I'm climbing on a rock face, I might have to give peak concentration because it's scaring the wits out of me. Because as many times as I do it, I'm still doubting that rope.
Yeah.
Somebody else gets on there and they've got complete trust in the equipment. Yeah. And that brings a different level of thinking to it, because they're not worried about the rope the whole time.
Less stress, less anxiety, or all those external factors. Because it's quite interesting, because obviously, where I first kind of maybe stumbled on this thought process around how much of an impact and influence this may have was actually just, in a piece I read about the difference between Russian wrestlers and American wrestlers, in that Russian wrestlers, they go after flow, which isn't necessarily the case traditionally for the American wrestlers. They go off the peak to the point where actually the Russian wrestlers are engaging in sparring or grappling with someone who is going off the peak. They actually resist the interaction because they're so keen on staying in flow rather than moving to peak. And then it made me think, I then look at myself and the way I train, and when I feel most enjoyable, and when I feel like I've actually extracted the most from it, and when for me time has flown, if you like. Well, actually, I'd have to do more reading to really identify, from your perspective, what the characteristics are that are associated to flow. But I certainly feel like I can understand when I'm in flow and when I'm going off the peak or when I'm in peak. Does it have to be different?
It has to be different if you're a researcher in these things and you're trying to define what it is.
Yeah.
I think if you're an athlete, no, it's you're concerned about whether you performed to the level today or not.
Fine. So then within that, Kenny, if I bring it back to this games-based approach stuff, really my experience would tell me, I'm happy to hear otherwise, that the reason why the games-based approach can be effective and useful is because it probably, whether the research points this out specifically or not, but is it possible that it could lead players to be more in flow because of the engagement factor?
I think that's a pretty good hypothesis. And I think the last part is the engagement factor is the key.
Yeah.
Anecdotally, when I ask players, tell me your most memorable practice session, it's generally when they've played games. One sticks out. I interviewed someone for a research project, and he said, we had a coach who every time we lost a game, he would punish us on Wednesday night by playing a trial game. It was our best training session. We were playing a game. He thought he was punishing us by having a game in the middle of the week. We loved it. It was the best training session.
So then, because this is another idea that I'm playing around with, I don't know if there's any research that kind of correlates to it or not, but it's all about the feeling. It's all about emotion, right? We've got a practice session tonight. We do a training session tonight. What's the first thing players are going to do when they get there? Well, they're going to try and get the balls. They're just going to start smash the ball at the goal. Now, I'm toying with the idea that actually they do that because it's not necessarily the action. It's the emotion linked to the action and the perception of what that action will then bring them. If we can tap into that, be clever and creative with the way in which we then design our practices, our games, and the constraints we put it, the conditions we put on it, and the incentives we apply to that, to then create a situation where we can, if you like, invoke that emotion and that perception of that action of scoring or hitting the ball in the goal to, let's say, a tackle to, let's say, an aerial duel, whatever it may be. Can we get everyone in flow? And now I will for everyone's flourishing. I don't know. It's just a magical idea in my head. Whether there's any truth to it or I don't know yet. I mean, I certainly have a belief and faith that there is something there. But I don't know if there's anything enough in the literature or if you can maybe add some insight around anything on that.
I wrote a blog on that on my Learning Through Sport blog. And my understanding is that emotion helps us create memories. Exactly. So many things happen to us in our lives. The things that we remember tend to have an emotional response. So a mate of mine who is a physical activity entrepreneur, he talks about the importance of creating the Monday morning story. So whenever he runs an event, part of his planning is, I want people talking about this physical activity on Monday morning. How I'm like, and that's what color runs do. At the end of your color run, there's all these photos of you with this powder all over you, creating a Monday morning story. It's no different than going a normal 5K run, except at the end you get spray painted.
Yeah.
But the spray paint gives you the Monday morning story. Look at all these colors and look at us all. And there's photos.
Experience.
Correct. And what are people talking about at the water cooler on Monday morning? Or over a cup of coffee.
Yeah.
Oh, I saw that photo of you. Gee, you look great with all those colours all over you.
Yeah. I mean, you're just taking my mind in a different direction now, because one of the things I'm thinking about as you're speaking is, and it's, again, we're going full circle because we're talking about areas and specialism and niches and things like that. I think like one of the things that I feel like I'm effective at and have a real keen interest in is actually in the way in which I communicate my messages to my players. And I actually stumbled on it by accident, really, because it was just a way in which I learned and I processed information that you could give me a whole bunch of things that you're saying to me. I don't understand your words, but I see it as an image. And then, as an example of that, I'll say, okay, a recent example I've used with players, you know, we talk about the idea of receiving open body shapes and being side on and being open so that we can play in both directions. Now, for me, that's all well and good, but actually that can go over anyone's head, depending on what their contextual understanding of the, and how knowledgeable they are already on the subject matter, right? So when I hear those messages, all I can see in my head is Nemo, the fish, right? So when I'm saying to players, yeah, just think about Nemo. So you know, the idea being that, okay, if I need to be able to see both directions, it's exactly how a fish would see it. They don't see what's in front, they see what's on the sides. So if I imagine that both my shoulders are my eyes, I need to have one, you know, seeing where the ball's coming from, and the other one maybe seeing where I want to take it. Now all of a sudden I'm in an open body shape in relation to the context of the game and how I want to operate within it. Now, ever since I started using, well, my understandings and my imagery around all the different, you know, aspects of coaching with players, I found that the messages stick. And, you know, again, I haven't done any actual testing or analysis on it, but my strong belief is that actually it's because that the image has now invoked an emotion, and the emotion could be as little as a form of pleasure. Oh, I get it. Yeah, such a simple message, and now I feel happy about it. Does that make sense? I don't know if I'm standing a bit airy fairy here, but I think there is something there. And you know, then it leads me down to this other path where I said, you know, and I have this conversation as a coach developer with coaches. Sometimes you're not going to be able to explain everything, but sometimes you know it's the right thing to do in the moment. And that's coming back to instinct, intuitiveness, and just not necessarily being able to explain it, but you understand some of the variables that are existent within that environment and the context of that moment, if that makes sense.
Yeah, using metaphors, and there's a lot of evidence that metaphors help create understanding.
Mm.
You're attaching also, you know, everybody knows Nemo. Nemo's really cute, brings back a nice memory. Helps to focus on, let's be like Nemo. But it's the metaphor that's really powerful in the communication, because people get it. It brings up an image. and that image helps them to make sense of what you're trying to explain. In volleyball, we talk about look through the window to get the hands in the right position with the thumb and the finger. So again, a metaphor, an image, which helps get the hands organized in the right position. Then if the hands don't get in the right position, you might be going, well, it's probably to do with the elbow. So we're looking at body shape again. Elbows probably weren't wide enough. So we talk about chicken wings. Everyone goes, yeah, I didn't have chicken wings to look through the window. So again, use of metaphor, bringing up the images creates that memory peg. Yeah, I know, chicken wings. Chicken wings brings up a nice memory for me. I know, chicken wings.
No, I love it because the thing is, right, it gets to a point where, I think, you know, now the more I think about it, is actually the emotion it probably is created, because in some cases they're looking at the imagery and the metaphors that we attach to it as very playful and very, in some ways, silly. But actually, it makes sense. Therefore, now, again, it brings up that emotion piece, right? Yeah, we're going to go off on a tangent here. But no, I find, honestly, Shane, I think there's so much in what you've said already that, you know, I think is has been of great value and great reflection for me personally, and I'm sure it has been for some of the listeners as well. But I guess from, you know, on a final note, my question to you would be, what would be your key takeaways that you really want coaches to consider off the back of this conversation, just to maybe think about applying in their own practice?
Play games more often, but play them with purpose. So you're the coach. You know your players, where you want your players to go to. So the game is an educative tool. You use it educatively, purposely, by the questions that you ask, the cues that you use to cognitively set how you want them to be thinking about the outcome of the play, but playing more often. Hey, kids come to football because they want to play football. They go to training because the coach says you've got to go to training to play the game. So if we want more kids to play, make training playful.
I think you're spot on, and I think it's a great piece of advice. So I guess just to build on that then, Sean, obviously, Shane, you mentioned there you've got a blog, obviously a researcher. Where can people go to find out a little bit more about the stuff that you put together?
I've got the Learning Through Sport blog. Easy enough to Google and you'll get hold of that. ResearchGate has all of my publications. So if you don't have access to the journals, you can sign up to ResearchGate and get hold of pre-pubs, or if they're open access, copies of all the research that I do. Google me through Flinders University if you'd like to send out an email and connect and have a conversation. So Google Flinders University and that'll give my email address.
Your time today, I really appreciate it. It's been really insightful, and it's been a lot of food for thought and even just clarity for me in terms of my own journey, my own perception. So I really appreciate that.
Great to have the chat. Thank you for the invitation.
Well, there you have it, guys, another episode of the Coaches Network podcast, where our aim is to bring the world of athlete talent and personal development together to just one platform. And you can help us with that mission right now by sharing this episode or any of your favorite episodes with everyone that you can think of. You can tag us in those mentions as well on Instagram at The Coaches Network or on Twitter at The Coaches Net. We look forward to hearing from you. Let us know what you thought about today's episode. And until next time, guys, take care.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.